This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
DC for you. DC for you. DC for you. DC for you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the only all DC Comics dedicated podcast right here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. This is DC for you. I am one of your hosts, Russell Sellers, and with me, as always, is the manager himself, Todd Weber.
Russell Sellers, what an honor it is to co-host a show with you. And tonight, it's just us, and yeah. We're talking Justice League of America, that is.
Yes. We've not really done one quite like this before. This is, of course, kicking off August and Justice League month. So we are surprisingly without a guest. We usually have one for these hour long episodes, but we decided to make it just us, and that worked out pretty well. I think this is going to be one that we can kind of dive into a little more in depth, because I think we both got a lot to say about Justice League.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've been reading most of my life. You know, I think I've told stories about one of my key comics as a kid growing up was Justice League of America 200, and I was never too far from the book after that, reading through the Detroit era and some of the Satellite, then the Detroit, then the Blah-ha-ha era, then kind of the back to basics era in the 90s, which we will definitely talk about today, and still collecting and reading Justice League as written by Scott Snyder to this very day.
That is quite an ongoing collection. Now, for me, I didn't get into really collecting Justice League until the New 52 started up and you had Jeff Johns on the book. I had read a few Justice League stories off and on in there. You know, usually your ones that were available in trade paperback, stuff I could get my hands on pretty easily. But as far as really collecting the book, I didn't start until Justice League essentially started over with this incredible superstar team of Jeff Johns and Jim Lee. Jim Lee, of course, being on art. And honestly, the opening story of that, looking back on it, I find it to be just kind of okay. It's gorgeous to look at, but it's not really that great a story. It's very, very basic.
It's extremely basic. Yeah. Took the word right out of my mouth on that one.
That's how I feel about it. But luckily, Johns would certainly find his footing on Justice League and go on to have a pretty tremendous run of it, working with some artists, I think, who were better suited to this team book than even Lee. So we'll get into discussing a little bit more of that a little bit later. So you mentioned LA 200, and I think we'll probably be talking a bit about that later on in this month. But I guess we should dive right into it and tell the people,
yeah,
if there's a Justice League story that you'd put in somebody's hands that's maybe never read this super team before, I guess we should tell the people which ones we would start with. But of course, people should know that the Justice League typically consists of your top tier DC Comics heroes. You know, you typically led by the Trinity of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and then a lot of your other stalwarts like Green Lantern, Aquaman, of course, Martian Manhunter, and a varied lineup of other heroes as the team goes along. So
yeah, we should maybe say There's been retcons about who the original groups were, the original Justice Leaguers were. But when I think Justice League, I think the big three, the Trinity, and then Flash, Green Lantern, Aquaman, and Martian Manhunter. So the Magnificent Seven, I can think of them as.
That's the classic lineup all day, and it's a really great lineup. I think at the before we go into the second half, we should definitely tell everybody who our preferred Justice League lineup is. Like, if you were writing the book, who would be your JLA? But we'll get to that before we go to the break. So, Todd, thinking about, like, a story that you think would be just perfect for turning somebody into a Justice League fan, maybe a regular Justice League reader, what's the first story you would go to?
Okay, so I did think about this one. Even though there have been continuity reboots and restarts and Everything You Know Is Wrong and all these characters have been kind of tossed out the window and started again, I think there are a couple things in the Justice League I can point to as something you should read to give you the gist of it. And the first thing I'm going to pick is something I know I'm going to predict would be Ben Morris would also pick.
And, I know what this one is.
And this is JLA Year One.
Yep,
was that what
is.
You were thinking?
Yeah, that's exactly
Mark
it.
Mark Waid, Barry Kitson. I mean, it's just fundamentally classic adventures of the original team retold with more contemporary art and story, certainly. Wonderfully done. Great covers, too. Just a fantastic year-long 12-issue run. Perfect trade paperback, but I don't read trade paperbacks anymore. I read digital versions of these. So it's found on the DC Universe app under JLA Year One, 12 issues long. And you go through the classic team, and then you get the additions throughout. So you get some of the at the very end of it, you know, you get the classic crossover with the Justice Society. And that was an annual tradition for the Justice League for many years, where there would be a 2 or 3 issue team up with the Justice Society from Earth 2. But yeah, you go through, you've got the origin, you've got them kind of being revealed to the world and interacting with other heroes and villains of the time, like the Doom Patrol. So I would absolutely recommend this story. And it's kind of, like I said, about a retcon. It's talking about an original five of the Justice League that does not have the Trinity, which is pretty funny. It's post-crisis on Infinite Earths continuity, where the Canary was substituted for Wonder Woman and Superman and Batman were nowhere to be found. So it's a very interesting kind of story where you had Flash, Green Lantern, Martian Manhunter, Aquaman, the other four of the Magnificent Seven, plus Black Canary, kind of elevating her, at least historically. So I would say that's a great first story if you want to get some classic Justice League in and still have it not insult your intelligence. Say, to me, you know, you read up to maybe the original League of America run, which went, I don't know, 260-something issues. If you don't read anything before 180, you're probably okay. You can kind of, you know, there's some stories that are alluded to, but this book will give you kind of the greatest hits and everything you need to know. I think the original series got better at that 184 or so issue mark where Jerry Conway took over the book.
Yeah.
So that'd be my first pick would be JLA Year One. What would be one story you would point to?
That is a really tough one because there are just so many really good ones that I would jump to. But I think I got to go one from the modern era, and the one that I think defined the Justice League for an entire generation, and in fact inspired an animated version of them that ran for a really, really long time. And that would be the arc called New World Order that happened in the pages of a relaunched JLA featuring writer Grant Morrison, Nick Duke's favorite, of course, and artist Howard Porter. The gist of the story is there's a group of aliens called the Hyper Clan who come to Earth, and Superman kind of grows was like really suspicious of them. But you know, despite their claims that they're there to help, you know, keep the world from falling apart as theirs did, as they claim, they very quickly learned that these so-called heroes are not who they appear to be. This is a classic version of the Big Seven, honestly, because you've got the big lineup of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. You got Wally West as Flash. You got the I believe it's the Hook Hand version of Aquaman in there.
Yes,
Martian Manhunter is back, and unfortunately, Kyle Rayner is the Green Lantern in this book.
Oh man!
But this is
you guys.
But this is actually where Kyle is used more effectively. I feel like he's a pretty good addition in this story. Like this is Kyle actually being a pretty good member of this team. And, you know, I'm not a huge Grant Morrison guy. I never have been, but I will say that there are times when he's real, real good. I point to All-Star Superman, and his Doom Patrol run gets a lot of heavy praise. In fact, his Doom Patrol actually very much inspired the hit TV show on DC Universe. But his Justice League inspired the Bruce Timm universe version of Justice League. And in fact, if you go watch the pilot episode, the three-part pilot episode of the Justice League animated series called Secret Origins, it is heavily influenced by this story. So I got to say, this is one that I think is just going to grab you from the opening page. It's one that definitely sucked me in whenever I read it. I was like, this is really good stuff. Morrison is at like the peak of his game. He's really like fleshing these characters out, showing you the team dynamic, getting unique voices and like very like natural and genuine feeling voices for each of the characters. So really good stuff. There's something that I think would turn anybody into a JLA fan. Like if you've ever wanted to see the Justice League at their best, I think New World Order is a prime example of it.
So we're talking JLA number 1 through 4 from 1997.
Yes.
Very good. Now you know why I turned that question back to you, because that would have been my number 2. So I wanted you to have the honor of doing it. I had a feeling that was what you were going to say. Yeah, I know if we were saying this is a great story to read and learn what the JLA are all about, that's your book. That is. And then but we can also talk about, well, what are our favorites that now that you know the Justice League, what's a great just kind of single Justice League story that you can get to? And I was actually going to go to Justice League of America, or actually JLA from that year. Actually, it's 1996, not 97. I always think 97. It must have been late in that year.
Yeah.
Issue number five, right after the New World Order arc, you have kind of a membership drive episode or issue.
Oh, okay.
And where you get looking to expand the team, and you get a lot of the kind of hot heroes of the day. And, you know, when the Justice League expanded the original team back in the day, at least in the original continuity, the first character they added was Green Arrow. And so I always think of him as just like the plus one of the classic run. And this is a great Green Arrow story, but this is specifically a great story for a character called Tomorrow Woman, who was a very briefly introduced character. But I won't spoil too much about this issue. You also get a funny look at the Electric Blue Superman in this issue. Same creative team, Morrison and Porter, but it's a done-in-one, basically. And it's just really a special book to me. I like you know, that first, 12 or so issues very much, with the key battle, the Rock of Ages with Dark Side, actually, and then you get an Injustice League that kind of comes out of that too. It still to me is the best Justice League there's ever been, and it's a shame that Morrison went crazy not too long after this. I mean, maybe after All-Star Superman, I can point that was the last great thing I think he wrote.
the drugs hadn't quite kicked in all the way by when he was writing Justice League. Like, he was maybe just starting to delve deep on that. But fortunately for him and for us, there was somebody that followed him up that I think did it maybe just as good or better.
Yeah, I think I may have talked about him a second ago.
Yes, you did. Mark Waid is a hell of a Justice League writer. He gets this team dynamic. I think he gets it better than just about anybody. And I think no story points to that better than the story he did continuing on with regular series artist Howard Porter when they did Tower of Babel, which takes place in Justice League of America number 43 through 46. And the basic gist of that is Batman has allegedly a contingency plan for everything, including taking down all the members of the League. But his plans fall into the hands of one of his greatest enemies, Ra's al Ghul, who then starts putting those plans into motion and taking out the members of the League. And, of course, when the League finds out who concocted all of these plans, it completely breaks the trust between the members of the League and Batman. This is also kind of the birth of Batman's paranoid persona. Mm-hmm. This is where it starts, or where it comes to a full head, like where we really see it portrayed in story. And so many writers and artists would play with that as a storytelling element going forward. And I think it reaches its its real boiling point, or it's like its breaking point, especially with his relationship with Catwoman and the story Hush from Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee. Because of his paranoia, he can't have a real, regular relationship with anyone. But all of that is, a big callback to this Tower of Babel story that is absolutely tremendous. It is an action-packed story and has actually been adapted into an animated film in 2012 called Justice League Doom. And it features a lot of very familiar voice cast for those who liked the old Justice League animated series. So I'd highly recommend that. But before you watch that movie, or if you've already seen it, go get on Justice League 43 through 46. Oh, that's also on the DC Universe app. Pretty much that entire run, I think, from Morrison all the way through Mark Waid's run, and maybe all the way up to the end of that particular volume of Justice League of America is on there. Highly, highly recommended. What did you think of that story, Todd?
Well, that was going to be my number three. So there you've done it again, mother dude. I absolutely love it. And, you know, it picks up on that thread from the original Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller, where Batman has a contingency plan for a particular superhero who, in case that particular superhero ever got out of control, Batman had secretly researched and made a solution. And this kind of picks up on that. And having him create these not explanations, I'm looking for the word, fail safes to take care of if say Green Lantern got out of control or whomever. But with Ra's al Ghul getting his hands on it, we get into these things quickly. And Mark Waid is so steeped in the Silver Age, but such a smart writer, and I like the way he does his action. I like the way he does his dialogue. But his plotting has always been the best thing to me. You know, he really, really surprises you. You don't necessarily know where the story is going. So, that is my favorite, second favorite Wade story. But as far as kind of the contemporary in continuity, even though, you know, they've turned things around then with the new 52 and Rebirth, I still think that one holds up really, really well.
So. Yeah, I agree with that sentiment about Wade definitely being a Silver Age fanboy. Because honestly, going back and reading JLA Year One, some of his dialogue comes off as that.
Yeah,
like it's got a real Silver Age, or maybe it's a little fairer to say that it's more Bronze Age than Silver. But it still has that almost golly gee shucks thing going on sometimes. But I think that's because Wade just really loves that era. And since that was the beginning of the Justice League that he was trying to tell, he was trying to be a little lighter with it while sowing in some seeds that could be a little darker a little bit, you know, further down the road. And certainly that plays into what he was doing on Justice League at the time, because JLA Year One was written right around the same time as he was doing that Tower of Babel.
Yes.
So he was that as a mini, and then doing the regular Justice League series as an ongoing. I mean, what a load of work that he was taking on to himself doing all of that at once.
Such a shame that things between him and DC aren't great at this point. Would love to see him back involved with the books in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I would love to get him away from Marvel and get him back over at DC. And I would really like it if he were kind of shepherding certain lines in the DC universe. Or maybe like put in like a really nice big office chair.
You know, that'd be a great idea.
Currently occupied by someone with significantly less hair than he himself has. but I digress. That's neither here nor there. Now there are a lot of other writers besides Grant Morrison and Mark Waid who have done really great things on Justice League, and those two guys were really good with like the lineup, like the main Big Seven and like some of their like direct connections. But I think it would be remiss if we did not mention one of the other very important eras of Justice League that did not feature really well. It did not feature the Trinity, at least, and it certainly shines some spotlight on a very different kind of Justice League.
I think I know where you're going with this one.
Yeah, this would be the Keith Giffen era on Justice League. He and J.M. DeMatteis, who like co-wrote and with art from Keith Giffen, relaunched Justice League. I believe this was in the wake of 1986's Legends event.
That is correct.
And this is often referred to as the Bwahaha era of Justice
League. Yeah, because Justice League International, sometimes you'll hear it called that too.
It gets retitled that later.
Yes.
But it started out as just Justice League. And the first seven issues of that, I think, took people to a Justice League team that would be very unexpected. And while it does have some fun action in it, it's built around being funny. And if you, let's say you went and saw the new Shazam movie that just came out, which was really, really good, you would probably really like this story because he's featured heavily. And this is one of the first times, one of the earliest examples of Shazam being, or Captain Marvel as he's referred to in this story, being portrayed as a young boy actually trapped in an adult body rather than being two different personalities.
Yes.
So that I think is going to lend itself to some big comedy. And also, if you have never read a Guy Gardner comic, this your one. This is the one to start with. This will make you enjoy. I don't know that you'll necessarily like Guy Gardner, but you will appreciate his presence, and you will love, in particular, one scene in this book that has become a running joke that still carries on to this day. It is just classic stuff. What's your take on this one, Todd? You were probably reading when this came out.
I was reading and buying when this came out. Came out, you know, like you said, post Crisis and post Legends, rebooting the entire Justice League with none of the stalwarts save for Batman for the first trade or so, and then Batman got busy doing other things, and the book didn't really need him. This was really an ensemble book, you know, featuring characters like Blue Beetle and later Booster Gold, and developing their friendship, developing Martian Manhunter into a very different kind of character, giving him an actual personality, bringing in some underused toys from the DC universe, much such as Guy Gardner, giving him a crazy personality, and using Lobo to great effect early on. So many great storylines, plots, and true humor that I associate with Keith Giffen from the 80s in books like Ambush Bug, The Legion of Substitute Heroes, and it's all kind of tied into here. He could do no wrong in my eyes as a writer back then. I would say DeMatteis is probably the scripter. Well, I don't know. I don't know exactly how the synergy worked, but I have a lot to say about this run. Development of Maxwell Lord as kind of a mastermind character. You get some of the development of the Suicide Squad, the original one, with them coming out of this book. So much went on during this, and it kind of lasted all the way through to the Death of Superman arc. And eventually it kind of fizzled out, and it felt like they were losing steam creatively. Certainly Kevin Maguire leaving and Adam Hughes coming on, Ty Templeton, guys like that. They weren't able to keep quite the consistency with art and the story, and I don't know where it exactly it lost its mojo, but shoot, for about 5 years it was pretty darn strong. Spawned that Justice League Europe spinoff, which was more of a traditional Justice League story. But this was still the prestige book. I just can't get enough, and I've gone through and reread a little bit. I have the omnibus, and some of it is a little 80s to me, but
it is.
When I was a 16-year-old kid, this was everything. This book was everything to me.
You know, it's a. I think this is a great book to put in a kid's hands. Like if you got a young teen or even like a preteen who's just starting to get into comics and they're interested in a good team up of superheroes, I think this is a good one. I think this would be perfect for kids in that age range. And this series actually continued on through, Giffen's run at least continued on through issue 60. And honestly, Todd, I think this book probably lost its mojo right about the time that Superman died. I think 1992, Death of Superman, that was about the end of the road probably for this, because this whole book was built around the idea of being, a more lighthearted take on the Justice League team. But then you got Superman dying and suddenly nothing was funny anymore.
Yeah. They wrote it in a more traditional pre-crisis type way, and it was just kind of not itself. So I'm thinking, how long did it go on after that? Went through to 90, or maybe went down a little bit further. It got a little watered down and changed. Yeah, and eventually needed to be rebooted by Grant Morrison.
And what a great thing to happen, because Morrison found a way to meld elements that had come before, but also like just plug himself into it. It was Morrison's book from then on, and he like as we said earlier, he redefined this team. So I think it would be fun though for us before we close out this first half to say who our Justice League team would be. And I think to keep it from getting too out of control, because as we know, the Justice League has sometimes ballooned its membership to unwieldy levels. Why don't we keep it to about seven? I think a seven member Justice League is about as big as you need to go. So if you've had some time to think about it, Todd, who would be your lineup? Who would be your Justice League?
Well, it's really hard not to just go away from the Trinity plus the Four, but I'll see if I can vary that. I'm first off Martian Manhunter, kind of a constant through all the teams up until the New 52.
Yes.
Somewhat controversially that he was not there for other reasons, but I would say core members, you've got to have a Flash. I would say Barry Allen Flash, especially, say, the one written by Mark Waid, LA Year One, that version of the Flash. So Martian Manhunter, Flash, I would say You've got to have Batman. You've got to have Superman. You've got to have Wonder Woman. So there's five. I would put them with Guy Gardner as six and Hot Girl as seven. Did I leave anybody out? Yeah, I don't need Aquaman in the Justice League, believe it or not.
I'm very, very surprised by that.
He's too good for the Justice League.
Okay.
I love Aquaman, but the fish out of water stories. And even, yes, I know. Water is 70% of the earth. Aquaman, one of my favorite characters, probably my favorite character, my avatar. But in Justice League, I think the dynamics that he brings don't always make for interesting stories, although he was very well used in the year one series we've talked about before.
Sure. You know, that's fair. I actually kind of agree with you there. I think that Aquaman as a character, he's got so much going on. He's got almost too much going on to really be a member, like a permanent member of the league. He can't really be at the league's beck and call at all times because, I mean, he's the ruler of the seven seas. That's late. It just doesn't make sense. So if I'm going to put together a league, I'm with you on keeping the Trinity in place. I think you don't have a Justice League unless it's Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman together. The Trinity has to be there. Now, when it comes to the other four, things get a little bit more complex because I am a big fan of that Justice League animated series.
Yes.
I'm a huge fan of it. So when I saw Scott Snyder's particular Justice League lineup, I got all sorts of giddy because he picked the Green Lantern that I would put on the Justice League, and that's John Stewart.
Yeah. Great team player. great leader.
Exactly. I feel like John Stewart is a great field general and somebody who, while Batman is definitely, you know, kind of in that same vein, I feel like John Stewart is one of the few GLs who like will stand straight up to Batman with no fear whatsoever. He is not intimidated by Batman. So that's my GL pick. Now, I would normally say Martian Manhunter, but I feel like whenever we've got Superman, a Green Lantern, and a Martian Manhunter in there, I feel like we have severely OP'd the Justice League. They're at a power level that is just like they should just straight up be unbeatable.
Yeah, unless you know you have a fire-based villain or a kryptonite man or what's Wonder Woman's weakness now? I guess we could say
according to Batman, none.
Right.
That's the greatest thing about Wonder Woman is that she has no obvious weakness, but you can. Maybe hurt the people around her, hurt the things that she cares about. That's
right.
That's how
there
you get. That's how you get to Wonder Woman. But for my fifth member, I'm going to be controversial. I'm going to steer headlong into it, Todd, because I liked the idea of including Cyborg. I thought that having him as a member of the league was right on. It was about time that he was able to graduate on up from the Titans era to the big leagues, as it were. Cyborg has earned his spot, and as a tech-based hero, there's a lot you can do with him, and it kind of pains me that so many writers just haven't. Like I don't know what it is. I don't know why they just gloss over all the cool things that Cyborg can do. I mean, Geoff Johns really did great with him in the New 52 Justice League, but anytime anybody else got their hands on him, it was almost like, okay, where's... Like Geoff Johns gave you all these good ideas to work with, and you're just not doing it. You're trying to force some of these other like boring long form stories that just don't work. I'm still waiting on a Cyborg in the Middlemen series, personally. That would have been fun. Cyborg is at number five. What's the league without a speedster? So you got to have the Flash in there. And I kind of lean the same direction that you do on that one. I think Wally West is the perfect Flash for the Justice League. Barry Allen is like the classic. He's the founding member of the JLA. But Wally is really good in this team. he's also really funny, and you gotta have some good comedic relief in there. So Wally West, for sure. And because there needs to be some magic on the team, I think there needs to be a magic user, and there needs to be, you know, it's sort of a boys' club up to this point. So I'm going to shift things around a little bit, and I'm going to put Zatanna in there at number 7.
Very good.
Because I think she is a tremendous character who works really great in a team setting and would be absolutely wonderful in an ongoing Justice League book. So if I've got a Justice League team, also she would be a great person to take down an out-of-control Superman because he's weak against magic, too. There you go. That's my 7 if I'm right in Justice League.
Okay. Nice choices. I fluctuate between Wally and Barry, you know, as I do, whoever my favorite Flash is. But I would say that the way they've written Barry the last few years has kind of adapted a lot of the things that I loved about Wally into it. So much as that this sometimes I read the newer Flash book and I feel like it's still having Wally's voice, but as a CSI for whatever reason. So I think you can't go wrong with any of our picks. I do love that you have to have a Flash Green Lantern on the team at all times. It just doesn't work without them. So what about artists? We did not talk about our favorite JLA artists.
We did not. That's an even tougher one. I'm sure you've got somebody in mind. Who's the artist that you think defines the lead?
All right. If you said George Perez, you'd be correct.
I hope George somebody Perez had that in the pool. You just won.
Yeah, no, that was pretty one of the safest bets one could make would be George Perez as my favorite Justice League artist. I mean, come on. He was the first good, and I will say Dick Dillon and whoever the other guys were, they were serviceable, but George drew the first almost, I won't say realistic, but there were the first aspirational versions of these characters I grew to love it around he replaced Dick Dillon when he passed away mid-story arc in a Jerry Conway written Justice League, Justice Society, and New Gods team up from the early 80s. George came on and things were never the same for Justice League. It was so good. So, yeah, and all too infrequently has had to draw them, but, you know, I still – you know, I have a cover, I have a poster, I have a canvas art of George drawing Justice League. It's just the classic team for me, the classic look of the team. I wish there was more of it out there. The Who's Who books he did, the covers for those have fantastic renditions of the Justice Leaguers. He did Justice League postcards. You know, everybody associates him with the Titans, but boy, his work on the league is pretty darn good. And I know you like Jim Lee. So there's that.
I do like Jim Lee, but Jim Lee is definitely not the person I pick for defining the Justice League.
I chose wrong. Okay, I guess wrong.
Like I said before, Jim Lee's art is pretty on his Justice League run, brief as it is. It's only like, it's about 12 issues. Still, Geoff Johns actually worked with somebody that I think was better at drawing the league on his time, and that is
Jason
Fabok. Yep, the much younger artist who came on to the book during the Amazovirus storyline, which is one that kind of gets glossed over in Johns' work because you've also got Throne of Us that he did with Ivan Reis, which is an incredible story, one of the best Aquaman stories that's ever been written, and the Aquaman movie actually pulls a bit from it. But then Jason Fabok, the young upstart, comes on the book to do the lead-in story that takes you into the Darkseid War, which closes out that particular volume of Justice League, and he is immediately revelation. This guy is just dynamic as hell. He's all the best parts of Jim Lee, Ivan Reis, and David Finch, all rolled into one amazing package. I just don't know how to describe it. It's lifelike, yet it also incorporates some of my favorite, more cartoony-esque versions of like superhero art. And it just jumps off the page. It's like these characters just fully come alive with so much detail. And you just wonder, how is this guy able to do this on a monthly book? Oh, wait, he didn't. They had to delay the book multiple times in order for him to keep up. Worth it. This is one of those few times where I'm like, I didn't care. I was like, delay the book, whatever. Just make the book look real good. And every issue just popped more than the one before it. And to this day, I really like what's happening on Justice League right now. I like Jorge Jimenez. I like Jim Chung. Javier Fernandez is not too shabby either. And even Brian Hitch had a run on Justice League that, while not really all that good, it was drawn pretty well. I could say that for it. But to this day, I have not seen anybody equal what Fabok was doing. Jason Fabok is, I think, somebody that's going to go down in history as an all-timer Justice League artist. Short though his run may have been, impactful it also was, and you can look at those issues and say anything other than, holy shit, this dude is amazing.
Yeah, great artist, good choice. I wish there was, like Perez, I wish there was more of it. But yeah, especially during the Dark Side War, just tremendous stuff. And I think some honorable mentions for me, I would say Alan Davis with his work on stories like Justice League The Nail does great, great art. I was introduced to the great work of Kevin Maguire through Justice League. I do affiliate that era with him, even though artists like Adam Hughes came out of that. Bart Sears did great work back then too. And Alex Ross, of course, has done some great work on Justice League through his homage to the Super Friends series called Justice, which was okay written but beautifully drawn by him, Braithwaite and Alex. And he did a really nice one-shot with Paul Dini in the tabloid format that has not been digitally reprinted, I don't believe. But it's wonderful. It's called Justice for All.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up an Elseworld story when you mentioned The Nail, because the only honorable mention I've really got to throw out there is Darwin Cook, who did DC The New Frontier, also adapted into a beautifully Darwin Cook art recreated animated movie that is highly, highly recommended. Also, just a great Justice League story. It was his homage to the Silver Age, and you probably get like maybe the best takes on Barry Allen, Martian Manhunter, and Hal Jordan in that story. Also, really like the way he did Wonder Woman. That was some good stuff. Darwin Cook is sorely missed.
You said it.
There's a giant a Darwin Cook shape in the comics universe since he unfortunately passed away so young. But what an incredible legacy he leaves behind, including some amazing Justice League work. So he would be one I recommend. Well, with that, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about something a little more controversial than what we've already talked about, the live-action Justice League movie. What happened, what went wrong, and what are our views on the alleged Snyder cut? You don't want to miss this. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to be Nation wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to DC4U's All About the Justice League episode. This is Justice League 4U, of course. But here in the second half, after we've spent so much time talking to you guys about our favorite comic stories, we're going to shift over to the medium of live-action film. There's not really much to speak on when it comes to Justice League and live-action because they've only got the one movie. And boy, oh boy, is it not good. Train wreck.
It is a thing. It was a movie that played on screens, succeeded, came out right after
Wonder Woman, actually.
Right after Wonder Woman, which came out after Batman v Superman. So we're looking at the timeline. And then nothing between Justice League and Aquaman, is that correct?
That is it. It goes
wow.
Justice League, and then you go to Aquaman, which was way better. And then you got Shazam, which I think was even better than that. So upswing on the DC movies, that's the good news. The bad news is Justice League is a movie that exists. And
it's so bad. Where do we even start with Justice League? I think we have to start with Batman v Superman, actually.
Yeah, there are multiple reasons, so many factors why Justice League turned out the way it did. But it goes back to that. It all starts really at Batman v Superman. Man of Steel had been out. It was divisive amongst fans and critics, but still did reasonably good box office. But Warner Brothers was suddenly wanting Zack Snyder to do a sequel, but immediately put Batman in it because they wanted Batman in their movie because Batman sells. Batman sells big, which is accurate. But that movie did not turn out too well. I think that's fair to say.
I think underwhelming is the best way to say it.
Yeah, that's being fair and also some people's eyes are
yeah.
But the theatrical cut of that movie is not very good. It's also still incredibly long. It's over 2.5 hours long, and it feels like only of a movie. It feels like you got a bunch of action scenes and a plot that doesn't make any damn sense. At least that's how I watched it.
It's just kind of a mess. You know, they start out with the little social media scene of Superman, which we hadn't seen that side of Superman. But to me, it felt like this movie was doomed from the get-go. You know, the expectations weren't very high for it. When it was released, the publicity and press, it was kind of downplayed, I feel like. It was dropped in, was it November?
Yeah, Justice League anyway was dropped in November. Batman v Superman actually came out in.
I'm sorry. That was May or
yeah,
April.
Yeah, Batman v Superman actually came out on my birthday in March of 2016. And there was a lot of hype. Like I was very hyped going into it because I am an unabashed lover of Man of Steel. So I was very excited about Batman v Superman, and you know. Much like when you watch Episode 1 or Star Wars Episode 1 as a kid, You'll convince yourself that you actually really liked the movie you just watched. But if you give it enough time, you'll realize that the movie you watched was pretty trash. And Batman v Superman was trash.
The theatrical cut.
The theatrical cut is trash. The extended cut is certainly not as trash. It is. It has a lot more plot added back into it. The movie actually makes freaking sense when you watch the director's cut or the ultimate cut, call it.
Right.
And honestly, like, I could watch that version of the movie. That version of the movie I can genuinely get behind. It's still not going to be what I think the majority of people wanted. And it still represented Warner Brothers trying to move way too fast and get to story elements and like emotional story beats that felt unearned. And even like watching it now, it's like this all just feels unearned. The whole death of Superman thing doesn't work. And Justice League kind of picks up that thread. It's another movie that feels like it's in such a hurry to get to the big bad threat of like the biggest possible cosmic threat that that the DC universe has. They want to get to the New Gods and Darkseid specifically. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess to their credit, they went with Steppenwolf as the opening villain, but
yeah,
he's uninteresting. He's just kind of there. Honestly, he's not like interesting in any way. And I am supposed to buy that this version of Batman, who's just been like wantonly killing people in Batman v Superman, suddenly has like a full change of heart and
right.
is more the traditional classic version of Batman in Justice League. I don't buy it. It's too hard of a transition. And I mean, tonally, Justice League is a hard shift from Batman v Superman into something much, much lighter. And it's, I guess, when you look at it from that perspective, it's closer to what people wanted, but it's not a well-written and well-executed film.
Is theatrical, or is Justice League better than the theatrical Batman v Superman?
I think objectively, yes. But I don't think it's as like much better as like the critical reviews would have you believe.
Yeah.
I think that they are a good bit closer together in that respect. But when it comes to the, I guess, the overall presentation, Justice League at least has a like from point A to point B to point C to point D movement that makes sense. Like you can really follow the follow the plot as you go along, and that's to its strength. And that's something that the theatrical of Batman v Superman does not have.
Yeah, it feels like if there had been Man of Steel 2 telling that story, the return of Superman. I think, like you said, the need to kill him in Batman versus Superman, rushing through this whole thing is very unfortunate. It doesn't feel earned. Like we don't even like Superman at that point. I like the Superman who he becomes in Justice League, or at least that's a character I recognize a lot more than I do in Man of Steel, and I know it's a character arc, I know it's a process, but I would have liked him to get to be who he was supposed to be before he died. I wouldn't have wanted him to die to get to that point.
Exactly. Like if we'd gotten a fully realized Superman for a proper Man of Steel sequel and then built up to like, you know, maybe not in the first phase of their film, but maybe in like the second phase of DC movies, then you do the death of Superman, then I think you would have had a much better emotional response. Or like it would have felt earned. It would have felt like, okay, we really built this to build up our Superman character, and his return would have felt more triumphant rather than the return that we get in Justice League, which just kind of feels eh. Like,
well, and that's such a problem with a lot of these IPs that we're familiar with. If we say Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams films, they tried to go Star Trek II and the whole Khan thing in the second one, where we've just gotten to know these versions of their characters and their nuance. Unearned is a key thing. You know, you want to have your cake and you eat it too. You've got to do the work. You got to have a whole bunch of character development and maybe three or four films before you can get to those classic stories.
Exactly.
You know, like Star Trek had been out at property for 20 years almost 20 years when they did The Wrath of Khan. Justice League, we had just met these characters.
Some of these characters we hadn't even met.
Yeah. They had cameos in Batman versus Superman, but that's it.
Yeah, like we're introduced to the rest of the Justice League lineup. We get our introduction to Barry Allen, to Arthur Curry, aka Aquaman.
That's not Barry Allen. I don't recognize that Barry Allen.
And yeah, it's Barry Allen in name only. And then we also get Ray Fisher's take on Cyborg, which honestly was one of the better parts of the movie.
It is. And the relationship between he and not Barry Allen is actually really good. One of the better parts of the movie, but you know,
that version of Flash sucked.
It's so bad. It's wrong. It shows me that Snyder doesn't know what he's doing.
Snyder's casting decisions on a couple of areas actually really works for me, specifically Superman, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman, and Cyborg. Like, Ray Fisher was a good casting choice. Where he like whiffs on it, like just completely misses the ball, is on Flash. That was bad casting all the way around. Not good writing on Flash either, but that's a whole other albatross. I'm going to say it. Controversial opinion. You shouldn't have cast Ben Affleck as Batman.
Yeah.
But I don't say that because of Ben Affleck being a bad actor choice. No. Ben Affleck is a good actor. He's a good actor who would play a really great older Batman. He kind of did. The mistake was going for an older Batman. That
right.
was
a lived-in Batman.
Yeah.
We never got to see any of that journey of having to get – yes, we've had lots of Batman movies. Everybody knows who Batman is. But to present him as so different a character, I would like to have seen not an origin story, mind you, but a Batman solo movie before Batman versus Superman.
Do it the Burton style. Burton did a Batman movie. It was not an origin movie. Batman had been around for like maybe a year or two, and they didn't really bother doing a ton with his origin. You get a little light mention of it, like a little like quick scene, and then we move on. But it's a man who's already fully realized. That I'm fine with. Like a fully realized Batman introduced into this universe. Hey, that's cool. We had just had the Nolan trilogy, so we didn't need the origin. But the Nolan trilogy is part of the problem here. This is the other side of the coin, Todd, with why Justice League didn't work. We often refer to the problems of the New 52 at DC Comics as editorial interference. Well, the equivalent of that was happening at Justice League.
Studio exec.
Executive interference.
Yeah.
They wanted so bad to get Christian Bale's version of Batman, to get that Christopher Nolan Batman in their Justice League movie, but both Nolan and Bale refused to do it. And they were ready to move on from that character, and who could blame them? They had already put in their time. They'd done it. And Bale had no intentions of doing a Justice League movie or even being part of a larger universe. But the studio was still determined to do that whole older Batman coming back out of retirement. And there's that reason for it. And also because The Dark Knight Returns has been like made most popular Batman story over the last 30 years. So in their minds, they're like, which of our Batman stories gave us the most money? It's The Dark Knight Returns. Oh, well, we want to do that version of Batman in a movie. Do that.
And a lot of creators and directors have grown up at maybe not being fervent Batman fans reading it every month, or reading every single trade, but they remember The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can think of Kevin Smith and like that, who Kevin Smith, a huge Batman fan, but he was hyping the Justice or the Batman versus Superman version of Batman so much ahead of time, years ahead of time, just saying this is Frank Miller on screen. And it doesn't hurt that, you know, Kevin and Ben are good friends, but I don't know. It's just, why you got to do that? Let it be a new thing. Let it not.
Yeah, like develop your character out. Because, I mean, if they were really going to look over at Marvel Studios and say, oh, we have to hurry up and catch up to that, let's go ahead and put the most well-known and most popular version of our big character on screen right now. All that's doing is, you know, saying that you don't get how to really build things up. You're not really paying attention to what Marvel is doing, because hell, they made a Guardians of the Galaxy movie,
yep,
out of a bunch of characters that nobody had ever heard of. And now every single one of them is a household name because they made a good movie around them. That's the key. Make a good movie first. And then your characters will develop into what they need to be. But that's not what they did. They just wanted to hurry up and get to this big team up movie, and you know, that's that whole executive interference thing caused it to be just this,
yeah,
like thrown together, slapped together mess that it turned out. But I don't think we can say that the two things that we've mentioned up to now, the executive interference and the reactions, like the knee-jerk reaction to Batman v Superman, are the only things that led to Justice League being what it is, because there is a very tragic side to this story as well. One that certainly had a huge impact, and that was the death of director Zack Snyder's daughter during the process of filming this movie. She very sadly, very tragically committed suicide. And naturally, that pulled all of Zack and Deborah Snyder's attention away from the film, and rightly so. And as a result of that, in order to keep the movie on schedule, a different director was brought in, and that was Avengers director Joss Whedon, who wasn't just brought in to finish directing the movie, but was also brought in to do heavy rewrites and reshoots of the film. We don't know if this is actually true or not, but there are like a lot of stories out there that he allegedly reshot the entire movie.
Yeah. And nobody knows just exactly how much of it is Snyder's, how much of it is Whedon's. There's not a scene by scene breakdown, though you apparently can tell, you know, where the lip is fake and all that stuff. But tonally, tonally, the movie is all over the place.
Yeah, it jumps back and forth from being the dark and gritty version that Zack Snyder was known for. Like, I think those Aquaman scenes in particular have a very Snyder-esque feel to them. And even the fight scenes, I think the train tunnel fight scene has a very Snyder feel to it in terms of its action and how it's all framed and set up.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get to pretty much every Superman scene in the movie is definitely a Joss Whedon joint.
Yeah.
It's way too light and a little too jokey at times.
Your take on the first scene of the Superman selfie part? Is that Joss or is that Whedon? I mean, I'm sorry. Is that Snyder?
Oh,
I've heard it's Snyder, actually.
That was definitely shot by Joss Whedon. That's a very him thing to do. And honestly, I loved it. That's the one part of the movie, like whenever the movie starts up and that's the first scene we get, is these kids filming Superman on their cell phone, asking him, you know, about the fire that he had just put out and the people he just saved. And one of the kids asked him if he'd ever fought a hippo. That was adorable. That was a great moment. I mean, the weird uncanny valley thing on his face aside, that was a good scene.
I agree. It's just tonally weird to Batman has this guilt and this remorse of Superman being gone and trying to fix everything. He rounds up the gang. It feels like it should be so much bigger than it is, and it's just kind of underwhelming so often, but it is. It's subdued, and there are characters that have fun. Gal Gadot is certainly not bad, but she doesn't get to do a whole lot there.
That's one of the biggest problems I have with Justice League is that the movie was rushed out to try and strike while the iron was hot. But what they should have done is they should have like really taken a step back and fully delayed the movie when Zack stepped away.
Yep.
And
make her the centerpiece because she was red hot at that point.
Very much so. Like you could have like fully stepped back and said, okay, we need to fully reevaluate Justice League. We can keep all of what we've shot, but we need to reframe things and maybe do some additional scenes. And in the meantime, really restructure it around Wonder Woman, like you said. But then how about put out that Aquaman solo movie first? You could rewrite one scene in that movie, one little bit of dialogue to erase the Justice League connection from it, and James Wan would have turned you out a billion-dollar hit.
I don't know that everybody had confidence in it. They would have had to delay Justice League even further, or maybe put the resources that they put into Justice League into Aquaman, getting that out a year sooner. I think narratively that would be a better idea. That character have a success, and then you have more resources to get that out too.
You would have at least built up a little bit more goodwill for Justice League. I mean, Justice League comes out and almost completely squanders all the goodwill that Wonder Woman had worked so hard to build up, and that's a tragic thing. It really is. And with Zack and Deborah Snyder's exit, they don't on paper anyway, exit as executive producers because they're still listed as executive producers on the Aquaman film. But their time with the DC film universe is completely over. I don't think you'll ever see Zack Snyder's name on a DC movie again. And Justice League really was the end of that. But I would also say that Justice League very well could have been the end of DC films, period.
Yeah.
Because it comes out, and I think it's fair to call op.
It definitely bombed, did not earn its budget back.
No, it did not. And that is a tragedy. That is a travesty. This is your super team. This is like all of your big guns together. This should have been the biggest movie since the original Avengers. And it comes out with barely a fizzle. That's unacceptable. Yeah, I can understand why heads rolled at Warner Brothers after this movie came out. It sucks that Geoff Johns wound up having to be one of those that fell on his sword after this movie's just disastrous box office results. But somebody was going to have to, I guess. And
I wonder even how powerful Johns was up to that point, or influential. I mean, you saw his characters up there and his involvement, but weren't the big calls being made by the execs and Snyder? I mean, it just feels like there wasn't a whole lot of Geoff Johns for those first few movies other than Wonder Woman to me.
Wonder Woman definitely has his signature on it because he was actually on set working on that film with Patty Jenkins. And Patty Jenkins has referred to him as like her like filmmaking partner, somebody that she trusted with everything she was doing because he helped her to really get the character of Wonder Woman absolutely right. John was actually the main producer who was working on Justice League. As he and Johns were supposed to be dividing the duties of being in charge of the DC film universe. When it came to Aquaman, that movie is co-written by Geoff Johns and also co-produced by him. It was his final work in the DC film universe before kind of being shown the door, which I think is a testament, really, because Aquaman went on to big bucks and also to do pretty well with critics overall. So I think that that really kind of illustrates his abilities as a storyteller and somebody who should maybe get his old job back, you know, now the dust has kind of settled from Justice League, because you've had Aquaman come out. It was a big hit. Even though Shazam didn't light the world on fire, as far as its box office take, it's easily one of DC's best reviewed movies. I mean, that bar is a low one to clear, sure. But it's up there with Wonder Woman, like in the 90s, I believe, on the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Yeah.
So it's a good movie. It just didn't have, you know, the big name recognition, but that's headed in the right direction. That's where you want to go. And the movie didn't really have that big of a budget, though. So it's done
fine. Modest success. Yeah.
Yeah, it's done fine for itself. It made three times its budget at the worldwide box office. So profitable film.
And we hope it's done well on digital and DVD. I guess DVD, Blu-ray, we don't hear all those sales figures, you know, but came out digital early July and DVD a couple weeks later. So, you know, I'm sure it's been fairly profitable, even though not the massive $300 million success that they had hoped for.
Yeah, like I'm a big cheerleader for that Shazam movie. I think that it was really well done. It was some of the most fun I had at the movies this past year. So it's just really great stuff. That's the direction I hope that they continue going. But there's one other thing we got to talk about before we get out of here, and that's the online community that exists around the alleged Snyder cut. I put that in quotation, Snyder cut of Justice League. There are people out there that believe that Zack Snyder shot an entire movie and that it's exists somewhere and that it was butchered and chopped up to make this Joss Whedon version, but that if the Zack Snyder version had been released, that it would have been a huge hit. Todd, your thoughts?
I think there was so much ill will that had been earned by Batman v Superman, which did well at the box office, but there were a lot of people who saw it and like that was awful. You know, they saw it in the theaters and were burned. So I blame a lot of – and I'm sure the DC execs, even though they weren't necessarily happy – well, they obviously weren't happy about what happened to Zack Snyder's daughter. There may have been some relief there that he had to step away from things. But the damage had been done, at least commercially, at least by the audience – or to the audience, where – I'm not going to see this movie. That was terrible with Ben Affleck as Batman and dead Superman. Even though Wonder Woman had done great, word got out that she wasn't going to be the centerpiece of this film. And a lot of the success of Wonder Woman was because non-traditional superhero audiences were coming to see it. Women and girls who wouldn't necessarily go see – well, now they would with the increased success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But a lot of people saw Wonder Woman who didn't necessarily see Man of Steel, for instance.
That's very true. My girlfriend has seen Wonder Woman. She absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
She has never seen Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, Justice League. She did go see Aquaman with me, and she went to see Shazam on her own and loved it. So,
yeah.
That kind of tells you what these, you know, who these movies are attractive to. And Zack Snyder apparently was not the guy to tap into the, you know, the female audience who is definitely there for the superhero movies. You just got to make a movie that these folks actually want to see.
And, you know, there's a cult of Zack Snyder. There is. There has been for years since 300. But do they really want it to be released out there, or they want the effects to be finished and it put out there, or they want it as, say, a DVD extra. I don't know what the harm would be in, say, adding it to the digital extras of Justice League, where you can compare and contrast it.
Yeah.
But I think it's just this misplaced anger of people.
There's a lot of that. There's people who are angry and don't know who to be angry at. And here's the thing, though, Todd. I'm going to just go ahead and say it. I don't think the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League even exists.
Mm.
I don't think that that's a real thing. I think that he shot a few scenes for the movie before everything really went down, but he didn't have a chance to finish even those scenes, and some of them wound up scrapped, and Joss Whedon came in and shot the rest of the movie. But as far as like a legit Snyder cut of this film,
right?
No, it does not exist. That is not
edited and yeah.
And to create one out of the unfinished footage that he has, which probably isn't enough to actually make a movie out of, it would cost Warner Brothers even more money, and chances are they would not make that back if they released it as its own release. So it makes no financial sense whatsoever for Warner Brothers to continue investing in this failed project. So they really should just cut their loss there and move forward with the individual hero movies and individual like other DC property films that they're working on right now, and try to undo or like at least repair some of the horrible damage that has been done to the IPs that they currently possess, because that's really got to be their strategy going forward. They have to repair the damage that's been done, and in order to do that, they've got to step as far away from the Zack Snyder DCU as they can, which is going to, I think, unfortunately mean a full scale reboot of the DC universe or the DC film universe within about 5 years.
You know, I think they want to throw out the old and keep the good. And if you just don't, you know, we're getting a new Batman movie, but is he connected to the DCU? I don't think so. I haven't seen that hinted.
It is not. The stories that have been written about that are that this Robert Pattinson, Matt Reeves version of Batman is going to be completely its own thing. It is not a prequel to the Ben Affleck Batman. It's a brand new continuity. Also.
Yeah, a Batverse.
Yes. Potentially a full Batverse. If this movie takes off and does really well, they want to create potentially spinoff films from it.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, these things are always going to be cyclical with Warner Brothers because they own it all. They're going to keep trying to get something. I think just wanting to copy Marvel was the biggest mistake they made, and not, or at least hastily copy Marvel, because you have to do the legwork. You have to earn it. And, you know, if we had 5 to 7 movies before Justice League, there we go. But we did not. We had 3. And those 3 didn't do enough of a job of fleshing out the world we wanted. And so when the Avengers meet each other, I know I'm going the apples to apples comparison, but when the Avengers movie, they get together and the characters interact for the first time. And in Endgame, when you have the extended families of the Marvel universe meeting, you know, the Avengers meeting the Guardians, it feels special. It feels must see. You did not have any of that, because we didn't know who half the team was, hadn't really had any time. So this movie is asked to do so many things that it's doomed from the get-go narratively.
Yeah, and it doesn't work because of that. And I mean, it's like you were saying, and it's like we were saying before, the difference is earning your spot. And like we like you just alluded to there with Endgame, all those extra characters from all these other movies suddenly appearing, we don't need explanations for them. We don't feel like we don't know who these characters are because we've seen them built up in all these other movies. Everything is earned. And that is something that the DC films just did not do. But I have some hope for them because of how good Aquaman was, because good Shazam was, and of course how good Wonder Woman was. I'm very looking forward to next year's Wonder Woman 1984, to an inevitable Aquaman sequel, because I mean you'd be crazy not to after a $1 billion box office haul. Of course, we've gotten some movement on that Black Adam movie, which is a Shazam spinoff. It's going to star The Rock. They've gotten a director recently. I forget his name, but it's the same guy who's directing The Rock's Disney movie Jungle Cruise.
Yeah.
And I assume that David Sandberg is going to be brought back to direct the Shazam sequel, or at least he should be, because he did a really good job with that first one.
Well, let's hope there is a Shazam sequel truly greenlit, or it would be very sad if that was just the end of it, because that movie was fantastic, and we had such low expectations for it, but it was really the most Geoff Johns we've really seen on screen. It was almost everything lifted from the comic and put out there. The tone was correct. The characters were great, and the action came off the page and really was reflected in such a way that, you know, you bought into it. I didn't have high hopes for Zach Levi, there it is, third pronunciation is the charm, as Shazam grown up. But even the trailers, well, that's cute, but I'm going to be able to handle a whole movie of this? No, it was fantastic. So let's hope that the commercial success can match the critical success of.
I think it will. I think that if they're smart, that they'll go ahead and put a sequel to that out, just like they did with when Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins came out. It didn't light the world on fire. It didn't make like a huge amount of box office, and it did it really solidly well with critics. Not like, oh my god, the most amazing superhero movie ever made, but it was like in the 80s somewhere, like solid 80s performance on Rotten Tomatoes. Good enough box office haul to land you a sequel, but then you get The Dark Knight, and it's widely regarded as the greatest superhero film ever made.
Right.
And it made over $1 billion at the box office. It was like the first superhero movie to ever do that. So I think what you got to do, I think they just need to keep hammering away. Like they found a good formula right now with Shazam and Aquaman, and hopefully with this new Batman movie, and even with this upcoming, oddly enough, Joker movie that looks surprisingly good.
Right, but again, it's more of a custodial thing for the characters and not the universe as a whole. So
yeah, exactly.
That's fine. Still getting the characters out there. And if that's what it takes, we don't necessarily have to have a Justice League movie, which is good, because we're not gonna for a long, long time now. Wonder Woman 1984 is the one I have my eye on.
Yeah, I'm fine without doing a Justice League movie, a Justice League sequel, or anything like that. There will never be a sequel to this movie. There shouldn't be. They should just put this version of the universe to bed and allow a new version of the DC universe to take its place, one much more focused on telling the individual stories of these different characters rather than trying to force them together in some kind of giant team up. Maybe eventually get to your team up, but make your characters count before you get there. Like really build their stories, build them up to be something that become must-see on their own, and then put them together, and you won't be able to keep people away from the box office. So,
well, let's hope so. All right, now I'm depressed. I need to go watch something to cheer me up.
I recommend Shazam.
Okay, well, yeah, let's see. I did buy it on digital last month, so I'll check it out.
Yeah, you should definitely go do that. Shazam or Aquaman, either one. But with that, folks, that is the end of this episode. We hope we haven't left you too depressed there at the end. There is some hope for the DC film universe. And, of course, we've just mentioned in the first half all those wonderful Justice League comics that you can go read. Every one of those are great, and they will fill you with all sorts of just, like, joy and, like, just giddy feelings to go and read more comics. They did it for us, and we're sure they'll do it for you. So that's another episode of DC 4. for You in the books. Come back next week. There's a lot more going on with Justice League Month here in the month of August, and we will see you next time.
DC for You.
DC for You.
Place to Be Nation, this is your manager, Todd Weber, here to tell you all about what's new on placetobenation.com. I've brought in a special guest to tell you what's going on this week on both of our podcast feeds.
Starting 8/08, PTBN Pop Feed. Todd Weber brings back Weber Has Issues in a new podcast talking about three new Marvel books and how accessible they are to comic fans. This time around, it's Marvel's Epilogue by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross, History of the Marvel Universe number 1 from Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez, and the much-hyped House of X number 1 by Jonathan Hickman and Pep Jalares. Jenny and Tim flip the script on this edition of Talkin' Pop by welcoming multi-show host and multi-talented Andy Atherton for a journey that touches on Andy's ventures as a podcaster, producer, screenwriter, bartender, DJ, and choreographer. The hard-traveling fanboys debut a new, potentially ongoing, theme, Fix It or Forget It. Up first, 2010's Jonah Hex, starring Josh Brolin and Megan Fox. Is it salvageable or redeemable trash? Pop Goes the Movies when Andy and J.R. Arsenio D'Amato get together to discuss the latest major summer movie release, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in a spoiler-filled review. On a new Sunday, Groove, David talks his current favorite songs, the new movie Yesterday, and the Beatles. JT joins Andy to talk about Kevin Smith's Dogma in the latest and greatest episode of Laugh in Theater. DC for You is back with the first week of Justice League Month. Russell and Todd discuss the JLA's greatest stories, adapted media, and creators, only on the DC4U podcast. They also discuss the divisive Snyder Cut. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There will 6 polls a day posted for round 2. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in. PTBN Wrestling Feed. Over at the PTBN Wrestling Feed, Ben Zani welcomes indie wrestler Yaden Newman to Row 1. Seat 1 No Holds Barred is back. Aaron and JT return with a GWWE, PPV TV match ever focused episode in the latest episode of the PTV podcast. JT, Scott and John D'Amato break down Survivor Series from 1989. Don't miss the pilot episode of a new ECW focused podcast entitled PTVN Extreme Three Way Dance, where hosts JT Rosero, Jennifer Smith and John D'Amato review the concept of the show and what is to come. On PlacetoBenation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 is off and running, with a brand new piece on Woodstock 1994, as well as a piece where JT looks back at Bob Backlund challenging Bret Hart for the WWF title on Superstars. Mention Glenn's weekly walk. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE, PPVN TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Thanks, special guest. For this and more, check out placetobenation.com. Your only place to be in this pop culture world.